are listening to the Tom and Curley Show. Tom Tangney here. John Curley called in sick this morning. We trust he's on the mend. And Felix Spinell is gracious enough to cover for him today. Again, thanks, Felix.
You bet.
So, I mentioned at the top of the show an hour ago how many big stories we have. And this is just another in a seemingly endless list of big stories. Today was the beginning or the start of the House investigation into the attack on the Capitol building on January 6th. And you had your first day of testimony. Now, just a quick little background. I'm sure John and I would go round and round on this, but I'm just going to kind of quickly run through what happened leading up to this in terms of the investigation. So originally, there was a call for a bipartisan commission that's based on the 9/11 commission, where I think Slade Gordon might even have been a former senator.
Yeah, I interviewed him about that too. I was going to bring that up. I had a good long talk with him about his role on the 9/11 commission 20 years ago. So
excellent, anyway, yeah, and it was balanced between. Yeah, it was a very bipartisan people. They took five on Democrats and five Republicans, and they were sort of like. Revered representatives of both parties doing the investigation. They came out. They didn't have a minority report or anything. That was the idea behind the call for bipartisan commission to investigate this. And the Republicans decided that they didn't want the investigation. They rejected the option. So then it was left to the political devices of the Democrats in charge. Pelosi decided, Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker, decided that she would have her own committee investigated, and she named six Democrats and one Republican, and she told Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader, that he could name five, and he did, and then she rejected two of the five, Jim Jordan and Jim Banks. Jim Jordan, if you don't know him, is a real flamethrower. He loves to throw monkey wrenches into anything the Democrats want. Now, if you agree with his politics, you think that that's a worthy role, but he basically was challenging the very foundation of the need for an investigation. So she just thought it was highly unusual. But she said, no, those two people have come out. Jim Banks from Indiana had called a press conference basically challenging the very notion that there needed to be an investigation of this sort run by, the Democrats. And so when she rejected two of the five suggested by McCarthy then turned around and said, OK, fine, you don't get any of them. And so he withdrew. The Republicans had no representation, at least through the minority leader's disposition. And at that point, Nancy Pelosi named a second Republican, Adam Kinzinger. If you know anything about who Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger are, they were two of the 10 who voted to impeach President Trump for the incitement of what happened on January 6th. Okay, all of that is just background. You can dispute it.
Could you repeat that one more time, please?
The facts are all out there. That's where everybody stands. So now, today was the first day of testimony, and we heard from four of the officers who were literally on the ground doing a battle with the protesters on the Capitol ground. So this first one, this is from Capitol Hill officer Harry Dunn, who says protesters repeatedly called him the N-word. He happens to be black.
One woman in a pink MAGA shirt yelled, "You hear that, guys? This voted for Joe Biden." Then the crowd, perhaps around 20 people, joined in screaming, "Boo!" No one had ever, ever called me a while wearing the uniform of a Capitol Police officer.
Yeah. And I heard that live on CNN.
Following the attempted insurrection, other black officers shared with me their own stories of racial abuse on January 6th. One officer told me he had never, and in his entire 40 years of life, been called a to his face, and that streak ended on January 6th. Yet another black officer later told me he had been confronted by insurrectionists in the Capitol who told him, "Put your gun down and we'll show you what kind of you really are."
Okay, so you were saying,
I stepped on that cut there. I heard that, played that. I listened to that live on CNN this morning, and they played that, unbleeped, and they replayed it multiple times, unbleeped. First, not the first time I've heard those words on American media, and they have different rules on cable TV than they do on broadcast, of course. But it was really, by the second or third time I heard it, it was really starting to get to me. I don't know if that, it was sort of an accumulative effect. Like the first few times, it was just sort of, anyway, it's strange to hear those words unbleeped. And we've heard that a lot the last couple of years, words like that. There's been this whole sort of the S-hole countries kind of line that was crossed a couple of years ago. It's the way the language is adapting, is or the way the media is adapting to the this new barrenness of the language is crazy, unheard of.
Okay. So, and here now is D.C. Metropolitan Police Officer Michael Fanone, who said nothing in his career prepared him for that day.
The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful. My law enforcement career prepared me to cope with some of the aspects of this experience. Being an officer, you know your life is at risk whenever you walk out the door. Even if you don't expect otherwise law-abiding citizens to take up arms against you. But nothing, truly nothing, has prepared me to address those elected members of our government who continue to deny the events of that day. And in doing so, betray their oath of office. Those very members whose lives, offices, staff members, I was fighting so desperately to defend. I agreed to speak here today and have talked publicly about what happened because I don't think our response to the insurrection should have anything to do with political parties.
Okay, let's go through the, we've got two more clips. This one is from Capitol Police. So again, if anyone needs clarification, there's a Capitol Police and then there's the DC Metropolitan Police Officers. First one we heard from was a Capitol Police officer. This, that one was a Metropolitan Police Officer. This one's another Capitol Police Sergeant, Gonnell said the events of January 6th were more terrifying than his combat deployment.
When I was 25 years old and then a sergeant in the Army, I had deployed to Iraq. From time to time, I volunteered to travel on IED-infested roads to conduct supply missions for U.S. and allied forces and local Iraqi population as well. But on January 6th, for the first time, I was more afraid to work at the Capitol than my entire deployment to Iraq.
And then he went on to say he, at one point, he thought he was going to die.
What we were suggested that day was like something from a medieval battle. We fought hand to hand, inch by inch, to prevent an invasion of the Capitol by a violent mob intent on subverting our democratic process. I vividly heard officers screaming in agony and pain just an arm length from me. I, too, was being crushed by the rioters. I could feel myself losing oxygen and recall thinking to myself, this is how I'm going to die, defending this entrance.
Okay, so this was the firsthand testimony. Clearly, they selected four people for, you know, for most dramatic effect, I'm assuming. You saw a bunch of this hearing. What was the overall impression? Did it feel like they were... I don't know, convincing. Imagine if put yourself in the position of someone like John, who has, I think, has kind of poo-pooed this insurrection as like not that big a deal. They were misdirected. They weren't, you know, armed. They didn't, you know, shoot anybody and all this. That it, to call it an insurrection is too much. Do you think this kind of testimony would change anybody's mind? Do you think it was effective in bringing to light what it felt like to be on the front lines? What were your overall impressions? Just emotionally.
It's really in sort of an age of political theater lately, whether it's spontaneous political theater like January 6th or, you know, depending how much planning went into it, or this more calculated political theater. It kind of reminded me a little bit of the two impeachment proceedings in the past couple of years. I thought the officers were all really solid. There was one guy who spoke at length. He didn't really say stuff that was necessarily soundbite worthy. It's a guy named Daniel Hodges. He did this sort of blow by blow about, like, the time they arrived, they pull up in the vehicle, you know, at 7:09, we walked across the street, and then you noticed a group of men responding a block away. He kind of went through it blow by blow, and it made me think about, you know, what Slade Gordon had told me when I talked to him probably 10 years ago about the 9/11 Commission. Slade Gordon, former U.S. Senator from Washington, recently deceased. Anyway, he said that, you know, the recommendations of that very, very partisan people on that group on the 9/11 Commission, partisan on each side, but they came together to do a nonpartisan or a bipartisan report and study. And he said, you know, the recommendations will get dated. Most of it's going to be anachronistic, but as long as we get the history right, if we come up with a timeline and a narrative that we can all agree to, then we will have done our jobs as commissioners. And I've read that a few times from that report that was came out in 2004. It is a really chilling, solid account, kind of blow-by-blow timeline of what happened and where in terms of the different jets that were hijacked, when they hit the different towers, when they hit the Pentagon and the response. And it is really, you know, it was agreed to by both sides.
Mm-hmm.
It would be, you know, I sort of, pardon me, missed Jim Jordan today. Because I missed him hectoring or badgering these guys with some inane comment about something unrelated to the actual topic at hand, but that would have given the proceedings a bigger imprimatur of actual bipartisanship. I mean, this is bipartisan. I get that. I get it's a select committee that the Republicans chose not to be part of.
Yeah.
That Nancy Pelosi got Kinzinger and Cheney to take part in. But it was missing that element of those badgering, hectoring, not loyal opposition, but the opposition who could kind of give it more of a less political theater, less of a calculated thing to make an impression on people.
Your wish is my command. So we do have afterwards the Republican leaders held a press conference, and we can hear from Elise Stefanik. But before we do that, since you invoked the name of Jim Jordan, who was promoted and then demoted off the committee, he has an interesting. I don't know who a person to blame or something to blame. Let's hear what he has to say about who really should be held responsible.
When you spend a year talking about defunding the police and actually defund the police, it's kind of hard to have more police here on January 6th like they should have done. That's the fundamental question. That's why this thing has turned into such a political charade. The police officers who will testify today, and frankly, all Capitol Hill police officers, deserve to have more help that day. But the Democrats couldn't do it because of the political position they had taken all throughout last year. That's the fundamental question that won't be answered. That's why Republicans aren't serving on this committee.
So blame the fire truck, not the arsonist? Is that what that is?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Jim Jordan that I admire as much as I can't stand him politically is that he's absolutely shameless. So there should be more people to back, you know, to back down the onrushing hordes of people who were using Jim Jordan as a rallying cry for why they should not validate the election. Yeah. And again, just to show how fair I am, let's also hear from Elise Stefanik. Now, the reason this is significant is Elise Stefanik is the Republican legislator, lawmaker, who replaced Liz Cheney in leadership when Liz Cheney refused to play along with the Republican leadership vis-a-vis Donald Trump and the insurrection investigation.
It is a fact that in December of 2020, Nancy Pelosi was made aware of potential security threats to the Capitol, and she failed to act. It is a fact that the U.S. Capitol Police raised concerns, and rather than providing them with the support and resources they needed and they deserved, she prioritized her partisan political optics over their safety. The American people deserve to know the truth that Nancy Pelosi bears responsibility as Speaker of the House for the tragedy that occurred on January 6th. And it was only after Republicans started asking these important questions that she refused to seat them.
Okay, and now let's hear from who she replaced, Elise Stefanik. This is Liz Cheney, why she thinks it's important to have this commission, even if it is run mostly, or investigation run by mostly Democrats.
If those responsible are not held accountable, and if Congress does not act responsibly, this will remain a cancer on our constitutional republic, undermining the peaceful transfer of power at the heart of our democratic system. We will face the threat of more violence in the months to come, and another January 6th every 4 years.
Okay, and then finally, Adam Kinzinger. Again, Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney are on the outs in the Republican Party. They are both fervent conservative Republicans, but on this score, they are dead set against the vast majority of Republicans in taking the what happened on January 6th seriously. So this is Adam Kinzinger reacting to the testimony of the officers.
I think it's important to tell you right now, though. You guys may, like, individually feel a little broken. You guys all talk about the effects you have to deal with, and, you know, you talk about the impact of that day. But you guys won. You guys held. You know, democracies are not defined by our bad days. We're defined by how we come back from bad days. How we take accountability for that. And for all the overheated rhetoric surrounding this committee, our mission is very simple. It's to find the truth, and it's to ensure accountability. Like most Americans, I'm frustrated that 6 months after a deadly insurrection breached the United States Capitol for several hours on live television, we still don't know exactly what happened. Why? Because many in my party have treated this as just another partisan fight.
Okay, so
that's a big pause. Yeah. Yeah. I do like Adam Kinzinger. There's something about Adam Kinzinger to me. He seems seems too opportunistic. Like he's been waiting for this moment to be Mr. Reasonable Republican guy. Is that too cynical?
I think you're too cynical in that he is sacrificing his political career by doing this. I can't remember now how much of his background. Does he have a military background or something? Anyway,
he takes
things very seriously. I'll grant you that. But I think he does see this seriously. And I think that he is somebody, like Liz Cheney to some degree, who may be willing to sacrifice their political career for something that they believe in. So I guess I have a slightly more charitable stance toward him.
He'd also be perfectly positioned to lead if there is, say, the Republican Party does sort of disintegrate over this and reform. He's the perfect guy. He's younger
Absolutely.
Than Mitt Romney by about 20 years, probably, right? 25 years, something like that.
Yeah, but if that's a calculation, I think that's an extreme calculation. I mean, that feels very unlikely. I think there are people that might even agree more with him than not, but I think they're going to be loath to anoint somebody who was so dead set against the vast majority of Republicans at a time like this. As much truth as he may speak from my point of view, I think Republicans will never forgive him. Liz Cheney might be a different matter just because she has deeper political roots in the party. Okay. Anyway, that's enough. If you haven't had a chance to watch the proceedings, I hope that those clips gave you a good sense of what day one in this investigation looked like. Okay. Sorry, Tracy, for getting so late to you. How's traffic? And you're listening to the Tom and Curley Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curley away today, Felix Bunnell filling in. And this is the time of the show when everyone stands up and cheers. Muckleshoot Casino presenting the one and only Rachel Bell.
Hello, hello, hello.
All right, our own uptown girl, Rachel. So I don't know if it was this week. Most of them last week. I think you brought us this ridiculous story of bikini bottoms in beach volleyball and how I think it was the Norwegian team decided to wear shorts instead of bikini bottoms. They thought it was ridiculous, the sexualization of these uniforms. And now you bring a different angle to women at the Olympics, even more heartfelt, it sounds.
I got to say, I've been feeling like Gloria Steinem recently. Gloria Steinem. I can't even say her name. I'm so angry.
What does Gloria Steinem feel like, by the way?
There was probably a Gloria Steinem at my synagogue growing up. There's one out there somewhere. There's just been story after story after story of inequality of women in sports, and it just makes me so mad because it's so easy to fix these things. So the latest one that I bring you today comes from the Tokyo Olympics. So in June, they announced to stop the spread of COVID that competing athletes could not bring their families with them to Japan. But what they didn't think about was breastfeeding babies.
Right now, I'm being forced to decide between being a breastfeeding mom or an Olympic athlete. I can't have them both.
That is Kim Goucher. She's a shooting guard on the Canadian national basketball team. And that's part of a video that she posted on her Instagram. She's holding her daughter, Sophie.
The basketball team's going to be gone for 28 days. People have told me to try to pump. I don't have enough milk in me to train as a high-level athlete and feed her currently, all while stocking 28-day supply. It's 2021. Let's make working moms normal.
What she says at the end is, it's 2021. Let's make working moms normal. I love how Canadians say mum, just like the British. So at the end of June, the Tokyo Olympics, they actually listened and they loosened the policy. So breastfeeding babies are allowed now to accompany their athlete mothers, but they are not allowed in the Olympic Village, which is where the Olympic competitors stay and spend all of their time. So the babies would have to stay at an outside hotel with a caregiver, which is a very stressful inconvenience because obviously these people, these women, everybody there is really focusing on their sport, sure. And doing all the things they need to do. And now they have to worry about, you know, either leaving to go to the hotel or the babies can't come in. So this is definitely an issue.
It's doing the athlete a disservice to not have something in place to support them and help them so that they can focus on, you know, one of the most important athletic performances of their life.
So that's Laura King. She is a pro gravel cyclist. I just learned what that is. Do you guys know what gravel cycling is?
Yeah, Gloria Steiner did that a lot, I think.
She did. She did it on Friday nights after Shabbat service. She was so good at it, too. So gravel cycling is basically any off-road cycling. She told me it's the biggest growing category of cycling because people are afraid of cars on the road now. Anyway, when Laura King got pregnant, she said that she had a really hard time finding information out there on how to continue being an athlete while pregnant.
Yeah. My doctor said we do not recommend cycling as a sport during pregnancy at all.
Well, that is ridiculous, according to Catherine Cram. She is an exercise physiologist who has spent her entire career studying evidence-based prenatal and postpartum fitness. And she says that exercise is not only super beneficial to the mother, it's also beneficial to the baby. And there shouldn't be blanket statements saying you can or can't do an entire sport.
Yes, you can fall off a bike. But a woman who rides all the time, her risk is very different than a woman who's never ridden a bike. There are so many healthcare providers that it is not their expertise to know about exercise during pregnancy. They just make that blanket statement, and that is such a disservice to their patient. If they don't know, find out or refer. There's some discrimination for women.
So there's all kinds of benefits. If a pregnant mother works out 5 or 6 days a week for about 30 minutes a day, the fetus is stronger, more resilient. There's more blood flow to the placenta. They say that the mom and the baby maintain these healthier weights. And Laura, of course, did not listen to her doctor because she says, you know, this isn't just a hobby. This is my life. This is what my husband and I do. Her husband was in the Tour de France at one point. So listen to what this woman, I mean, the stories give me chills. Like, this is what she did while pregnant.
I rode my bike over 4,600 miles during pregnancy and competed in races.
Which she got second and first place in.
How far into your pregnancy did you continue to ride?
I rode 2.5 hours the day before I gave birth and then 6 days after having a baby.
And then after having the baby?
There were times where I'd stop and I'd be eating and I would pump then and bring the milk in a little freezer milk bag home in my back pocket. But then there were other times where my husband came along and brought our daughter in the car and followed me, and I was able to stop and breastfeed along the way. But then one of them I did on my own and ended up just pumping while I was riding, and it worked. I didn't know if it would.
Multitasking.
Yeah, because that was a 12-hour day.
Yeah, so I wanted to kind of like expand it into that story. Once I started talking to Laura, I just realized, you know, there's so much more to it. And you can think of how many women, you know, never get to the pro or Olympic level because they're forced to make that choice because they think, well, how am I going to do both because the sport doesn't accommodate it? And so, you know, both a doctor telling an athlete with a healthy pregnancy, that's the key, a healthy pregnancy, to stop engaging in their sport, and the Olympic Committee, you know, not considering the biological needs of female athletes, which is half the people competing. I just think that this furthers the gender inequality that already exists so much in the sports world, be it how much people are paid and how they are treated.
It's just astonishing. I've watched the Olympics in my entire life, it never once occurred to me that you could have women that close to pregnancy that they're still breastfeeding and still be able to compete at an Olympic level. That alone seems worthy of a medal, let alone, you know, any kind of accommodation for them. Of course the Olympics ought to accommodate them. They're already miracle women by, you know, performing and breastfeeding at the same time. It's remarkable. And yes, we should be doing everything we can to support them. And fascinating information too about, yeah, how much more women's bodies can, you know, sort of put themselves through to benefit the baby, not just their own selfish desire to compete. It's actually a benefit of the baby. Fantastic. That was a real eye-opening story, Rachel.
And I will add, I don't have it up yet. I'm getting it up there. But if people go to mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell, in let's say an hour or so when I get the story up, we do have somebody in Seattle who is an expert in this field, which we're really lucky to have because there are very few of them in the world, because this is something that is just being researched like in the last 10 years or so. So I'm going to link to that. So if there's anybody listening who is either trying to get pregnant or after pregnancy, you can go and consult and they will hook you up with what you should be doing for your body.
Fantastic. Okay, great. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
I guess you don't get any bye-bye music.
Okay, I forgot about that.
Should we sing?
Yeah. There we go. The Uptown Girl sauntering her way out of here. And now to our Crosstown Girl, maybe. Tracy Taylor, how are things on the road? You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here. John Curly under the weather today. Felix Spinell filling in. It looks to me like we might have time. This is a story that... Felix, you've got a nice personal angle too, but this is a story about dogs and kind of an excess of dogs all of a sudden in New York City.
Raven is one of many dogs waiting to be adopted at the Animal Care and Control Center in East Harlem, where officials say the number of pet surrenders has surged.
Our intake is almost tripled.
In February, the shelter was seeing about 21 pets brought in each day. That averaged 47 a day in June. And marketing director Katie Hansen says that the rate things are going, they could soon be seeing upwards of 60 animals dropped off daily.
It's just inching up more and more each month.
The dogs and cats being surrendered aren't the ones that people adopted at the height of the pandemic, when many shelters were nearly cleaned out. Instead, Hansen says they're coming from households struggling financially as various forms of public assistance taper off.
They're losing their job. The eviction moratorium is almost up. The extended benefits for unemployment are almost up, and I think people are nervous. They're having to make really hard choices.
On top of the surrenders, the shelter is seeing more and more strays. ACC is making a plea for people to adopt and foster before their shelter hits capacity. Republican mayoral candidate Curtis Sliwa thinks there should be an incentive and is proposing the city foot the bill for $1,000 in pet care for anyone who adopts from a city shelter.
All right there, so...
$1,000 from each. That's Curtis Sliwa, the guy who founded the Guardian Angels, I think.
That's right, yes. And that, if it's 60 a day... That's 60 grand a day. That's a, you know, but it, we cut it short there, but it turns out the city does a lot of that already. What he's calling for, they do a lot of support, for that. And it immediately, when I first heard the story, I immediately thought, oh yeah, it's all those darn people during the pandemic said, hey, I'm at home. I'm going to get a dog. We did a profile about that, about a couple of weeks ago. But then they say, no, that's not it. These are like dog owners pre-pandemic who now find themselves up against it because, of the kind of long-term effects of the pandemic. But anyway, we were talking about this story in our pre-show, and then you mentioned that you've done a good deed of late. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yeah, because a lot of the shelters and traditional foster homes for dogs are overloaded because of the wildfires all over the West. There's a huge need for foster families to take care of dogs for short periods of time. Hmm. We have a tremendous network of private nonprofits in this area, like Paws, where I adopted my own dog 5 years ago, my cat 15 years ago. There's a group called Dog on Seattle, who I went to pick up we found out about through my wife's work. Went to Bellevue to pick up this little dog named Bruce, bumped into Jessamine McIntyre, our former colleague. She was fostering an old dog named Wyatt.
From 710 ESPN.
Yeah, yeah. We got this little dog named Bruce, who's about 3 months old, and I think He's the cutest little dog. I don't know. We might end up keeping him. We're supposed to give him back and everything, but and it's really hard because he's just the sweetest, nicest little dog. But Dog on Seattle's website has all kinds of dogs that need short-term foster homes, 2-3 weeks until they find forever homes for them. And it's just the need has rarely been as great as it is right now. And if you have the time where you can focus on it or the work schedule that lets you give a puppy all the attention he needs around the clock, it's a really fun thing, especially if you got other family members to share it with. So it's I love Fantastic. Dogs. It's going to be hard giving them up. So
now, just to be clear, though, you said because of the forest fires, these are I mean, you're not going to keep somebody else's dog who just can't temporarily.
No, it's more that the people who ordinarily take foster dogs can't do it because there's so much going on, so much other distractions, and other disasters. They just need help from people like me who've never fostered dogs before. No, it's not stealing people's dogs, Tom. Boy, you always go so dark with this stuff.
You kick them when they're down. I thought you were suggesting that.
I drive around dog treats, just picking up dogs and putting them in the back of my truck.
Looking for a house that just burned down, and then,
that's me.
I'm glad we clarified that. Maybe I was the only one that
you
was
might have been the only
confused.
One, yeah.
I hope. Well, now it's perfect time then to turn to a real dog lover who would never steal anyone's dogs, Tracy Taylor, who has at least two yourself, right, Tracy?
We're fostering one as well. So we've got four now in the house.
Wow.
And Bowie is a Corgi Dachshund Terrier mix, and he is 4 years old, and he is just a bundle of wonderful, but he is looking for his forever home. We have a senior dog who's 15, and then Millie and Clark, and those guys are, well, they're just a chore and a half. But anyway, if you're looking for a forever home for a Dachshund Corgi mix, make sure you send me an email. I would love to get you in touch with the people.